Country Life on Midlands 103. Brought to you by W. Orshaw, Burlington Business Park, Tullamore. Supplier of New Holland tractors in the Midlands. WORshaw.ie.
Good evening and welcome to Country Life here on Midlands 103. It's MJ Cleary with you, bringing you the latest from the Midlands and further afield from the worlds of agriculture, food and agribusiness for you over the course of the next hour. Thank you all for joining me, and definitely milder than this time last week. In a moment, we're going to start the programme with Joe Patton from Chagas. The topics of conversation will be grass and obviously the weather. As I said, it is milder than last week, but still is it drier? We just heard on the news there about a lot of rain coming this weekend. I think we're going to avoid most of it here in the Midlands, thankfully, but some parts of the country going to be badly hit. We're going to chat to Joe in a moment. He had an event today in Moore Park. There was over 100 farmers down there, so let's see what they were talking about. Also this week, an interesting area and something that could be an income generator on farms. We are all familiar with wind turbines and solar panels, but the latest is the use of farmland for battery storage. So can't take much land for that, I hear you say. However, these are no ordinary batteries. These are large scale batteries that would fit inside a shipping container. So huge, huge, huge pieces of technology. And there is a big push on this. Marty Murphy from IFAC is going to take us through it a little bit later and tell us what the supports and challenges are in relation to it. At this time of the year, attention on farms turns to field work. And look, there is stock out all over the country now. As we said, we'd like grass to be growing a little bit better and we'd like weather to be drier. However, when you are letting cattle out, no matter what farm you're on, there's always an amount of fencing to be done. Never, ever, ever does it stop, fencing on farms. Robert Burney is a leash man and he's the fencing manager with FRS. He joins me later to chat about how this time last year, creosote was made unavailable. And as a result, the company has had to go to Eastern Europe to source long-lasting fencing posts. Finally, towards the end of the hour, rapeseed oil has seen a huge surge in popularity in recent years. And a local business in County Offaly has grabbed the bull by the horns and shown some real growth in this area. The Larkin family from Coolderry in County Offaly, their neighbours of mine, are just up the road. Eugene Larkin is going to join me later to chat about Glenfield rapeseed oil and how they do everything from sow to press and bottle the oil on the farm. Really shows what can be achieved on a farm when people put their heads together and are willing to put in work. Hard work is what's involved in this business as well. So a really interesting success story from County Offaly. We're going to be talking about that a little bit later. As always, text me here or WhatsApp on 083 3010 103. And as I said a moment ago, we're moving on now to talk about the weather, grass growth. We have Joe Patton from Chagas. Joe, many thanks for joining me this evening.
MJ, how are you?
We're good, Joe. You had an event in Moore Park today. There was over 100 farmers through the gates. What was the general mood, Joe, and what was the main chat from farmers you were talking to today on the ground?
Yeah, it was an interesting event, MJ. I suppose back at the start of the year, we had planned, at this stage, we had actually slated in a series of events nationally about clover establishment and reseeding, believe it or not, and that was the plan at the start of the year. So I suppose about a week ago or 10 days ago, we said, geez, we're not going to get away with doing those events. And the question was, what do we do? And we said, look, we need to talk to people and people need to talk to them, to each other, about the situation on the ground at the moment, with the spring that's in it and all the issues with conditions and feeding and challenging grazing conditions and all that kind of stuff. So we pushed ahead, and the first of the events was today in Moore Park. I suppose we were a bit apprehensive, to be honest, going, geez, will anyone get the time to come down to us? So we had about 120 farmers through the gate, and they were surprisingly positive, I would say, which is great to see. If anything, maybe, MJ, just the fact to get away from the yard for an hour or two and talk to other people and realise that, you know, you're not the only one in this boat, I suppose, for the moment. So, look, that was important. So we had a good, honest chat about things. Most people are well behind in grazing at this stage, as we'd expect. Very little fertiliser out. Cow performance and cow condition is something that people are a bit worried about. So we went through a few things around, you know, feeding, what we need to be doing, thinking ahead on the grazing situation, because look at what's done is done now, but how will we fix the problem if and when it ever stops raining, and a bit around fertiliser as well. So look, the mood was surprisingly good. I'd say people were just happy to be doing something other than doing cubicles and feeding silage for the last, you know, that was probably the main thing. So look, we were very happy, and as I say, we're going again tomorrow and into next week as well, with more on-farm events. So hopefully the host farms will be in good shape for those.
Yeah, growth rates is where the issues are at the moment, Joe. Lots of farmers saying, look, they are on a rotation, they have X amount of paddocks grazed, and the ones that are grazed for the last maybe 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever the case may be, are not greening up and there's nothing coming back. And it's, yeah, I know, look, it's early, it's the 3rd of April, and we are looking at maybe proper double figures this weekend, I think 14 degrees on Saturday, so we do need that bit of heat, but it's slow. Grass is slow to come on now.
Surprisingly now, and I know Donal Patton had it on the webinar we had last night, and he always makes this point, an interesting point. He says early April is always slow, MJ, slower than what people think, right? So the predicted growth rate is around 25 to 30 kilos. That is behind where it should be for, say, County Leash, County Offaly at this stage. But it's back by maybe 10% or thereabouts. It's clear then, obviously, with stuff that's been grazed, there's very little coming on those. But generally speaking, it does take mid-April that we get the kick-off. So, look, it's the big thing, and we've seen this on farms where, you know, fertiliser is well behind, and that's probably driving a lot of it, you know, because on the farms we're measuring measuring and predicting grass growth from, they are behind as you at the normal rates because of the weather. But I think on some farms where little to no fertiliser has gone out, you know, we're really seeing that, you know, because anything that was grazed early did need a bit of nitrogen to get started. And even stuff that hasn't been grazed yet will need a bit of nitrogen to get going. So obviously in the conditions, that's difficult to do. But it's a combination, I suppose, of weather. But I don't think we should discount the nitrogen effect on a lot of farms too. I'd be a bit concerned about it, to be honest. I think people have got into the idea to think this, possibly that the response to nitrogen isn't great in the spring, but I tell you what, you can see this year, even in this year with a bad year, people that have a bit of fertilizer out, they are seeing it greening a bit better. So we have to go back to basics a little bit on that when the weather dries up, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Joe, just we're seeing the end of the calving season now on majority of farms. Attention is going to turn to breeding. Covered last week, the calf scheme, dairy calf scheme, which was announced about 10 days ago, I think, at this stage. €20 a head for 50 calves. It's aimed solely at the dairy industry. Now, beef farmers have an issue with that, and I think rightly so, but look, that's a story for another day. Did that come up in conversation? Are dairy farmers going to have a go at this? My thoughts on it is the amount per head is so low, they may not, but maybe I'm wrong.
Not, I tell you, there's a lot of other things in people's minds at the moment, to be honest, NG, and it's really around, I honestly think so, dairy farmers at the moment are in survival mode around grazing and feed and all the rest of it, and that's where the main thing is. The concern, there was a little bit of a discussion around breeding, but it was more around, I suppose, protecting body condition and protecting herd nutrition for the moment. That's really where it came, and I suppose one of the things that did come up and was answered very well, I thought, on the day was the risks around, you know, use of sex semen, maybe, where people are thinking that we have always been saying to people that conditions need to be good and cow condition needs to be good to use it, and people are worried now, will they be able to use sex semen coming into this year because of the condition of the animals. So we're saying, look, there's still a month to go to breeding or thereabouts. There's still good scope for using it if we can keep the herd condition in good shape. And that's the big one, I suppose. What dairy farmers are thinking about is, to be fair, I think a lot of dairy farmers have made probably more progress than we thought was possible in a way around using better beef traits on the calves, probably producing a better quality calf to some extent that hopefully will be something beneficial to the beef sector, irrespective of any scheme. You know, this is a long-term thing we're looking at, that it become a standard thing. So there's an ambition there, I suppose, among dairy farmers to use better quality beef genetics. Sex semen will allow that to happen. A bit of a worry about cow condition at the moment, but I think we can resolve that fairly quickly. So, look, I'm surprised, well, somewhat surprised. I think the farmers that I thought would never have been talking about beef bulls, even up to a couple of years ago, are now, they're nearly asking about the beef genetics more than the EBI or the dairy genetics at the moment, MJ, which hopefully will lead to a bit better integration over time when the quality of calves is seen to be better on the ground.
Yeah, it's a positive thing. Joe, last question. Calf sales, obviously, flat out at the moment, last few weeks and up to this week, next week. Big numbers on show. Were dairy farmers today saying that they're happy, sad, indifferent about calf prices? Or are they just happy to get them shifted on?
They're probably happier than they're happy enough, to be honest. Obviously, look at MJ, I think we've spoken about this before, that the range in calf prices reflects the range in calf quality, really, mm-hmm. doesn't it? And that's that's the point. And dairy farmers have to be realistic too about what the purchaser of their calf requires. They need a bit of weight and a bit of size behind them, and they need help behind them and a bit of genetics too. That's the recipe. And I suppose on the other side then, you know, I suppose we've said this before, that beef farmers have to accept to some extent that dairy farmers can probably only go so far in terms of genetics. They're not going to be producing, you know, obviously not going to be producing through the U-grade cattle, but there's a lot of very acceptable cows being produced. I'm surprised, you know, look, it's not, I suppose, the usual sources of complaint, really. But in a good sense, I think lots of farms have probably surprised themselves at how they can change with one cross of a decent beef animal. They're pretty ordinary dairy cows, let's face it, can produce a fairly acceptable calf. But I would make the point that, you know, the sex semen part of that is really critical to us, to remove the lower quality calves. And we have to make sure that people are thinking like that in coming in for the next month, that cow condition is kept right so that the chances of success during the breeding season are maintained.
Yeah, absolutely. Joe, I'm going to say many thanks for joining me here on the programme, and we will chat to you again. Thanks, Joe.
Very good. Take care. Okay.
Joe Patton there from Chagas, and as Joe said, mood among farmers, not bad given the conditions. Look, we're not getting away too bad here in the Midlands now. As I say that, I know farmers might be looking outside at waterlogged paddocks and whatnot, and it's a broad statement to say Leash Offaly and Westmeath, obviously a vast area, but some parts going okay. Are a lot of cows out grazing full time now at this stage, and a lot of beef cattle out full time as well. The important thing to remember is, as Joe said, look, things change very quickly, a couple of days really, and if we get that higher temperature up this weekend, that's what we need just to kick things off and just to get grass moving. It is an anxious time when you're looking out and you don't see anything coming back on paddocks or fields, but as Joe said, 3rd of April, maybe we're a bit over-optimistic as to what the weather will bring at this early stage of the month. Now, moving on, after the break, we're going to be speaking to Robert Burney. He's a leash man and he's in charge of fencing at FRS. Going to be talking about their new fence post, which they have on offer, so stay tuned for that.
Country Life on Midlands 103, brought to you by W. Orshaw, Burlington Business Park, Tullamore, supplier of New Holland tractors in the Midlands, worshaw.ie.
And you're very welcome back to Country Life here on Midlands 103. And now we are moving on to the area of fencing. And we have leash man in the know, that is Robert Burney. He's in the know because you're the fencing manager with FRS, so it's fencing all day, every day, Robert. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you, MJ. Yes, surely is, that's every day.
Well, yeah, it's nice to be busy, Robert, but I'd say at this time of the year you're absolutely run off your feet, and we're going to talk all about fencing and your products in just a moment. But before we do, you're a leash man and you're over between Mount Rat and Port Leash. You're dairy farming over in that neck of the woods. How is the spring going for you, Robert? You're looking forward to a bit of dry weather and better conditions, the same as everyone, I presume.
Absolutely, MJ. The ground will be heavy down around us, and chance of getting out stockers quite slim, and anyone who has them out is only out for a few hours and back in again. In between the heavy deluge of rain from day to day, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, everybody in the same boat, and as we said, it really is differential. You probably see this with the fencing side of things as well, Robert, the differences in land and land types and where you can fence on a given day and where you can't fence. It must be something you come across regularly in the day job.
Yeah, I suppose the thing we kind of come up against maybe every winter, maybe wouldn't be expecting to have such a challenge just this time of the year, which we hope and fine weather will be kicking in. But yeah, I suppose, look, we're covering North Tip, Leash, Offaly, up into Westmead. And as you know, there'll be a wide range of different ground types within that. So you have to pick and choose where you'll go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we're talking about fencing and fencing posts. Creosote is the big one, Robert, and you brought it to my knowledge, speaking to you yesterday in advance of the chat, that it has been removed from the market a little over a year ago. I wasn't aware it was gone this long. I knew it was gone, but I didn't know it was gone that long. This is a big, big deal. It was the main product for fencing posts for years and years, and it brought posts into being longer and more durable and having them for 20-odd years as opposed to 3 or 4 years. So it's a big, big change to the fencing industry.
Absolutely massive. It's a total game changer. Look, I suppose over the last 20 years, creosote would have been gaining popularity every year. Look, while it would have been a more expensive post, maybe up to even twice the price of your traditional Irish treated post,
they were gaining a lot more traction, I suppose, due to how long they lasted, maybe three or four times longer than your standard post. So I suppose they're a huge loss to our business, because it would have been a big draw to the yard and business, but a huge loss overall to the farming community, you know.
Yeah, and it is that post that people can think of. People move very quickly. You basically had two options when it came to fencing posts in times gone by. You went for your straight up post that had a little bit of a green tinge to it, that was, as a farmer once said, that they'd almost be rotted before you get home to put them in the ground. They'd rot in the trailer. They lost traction pretty quickly. Farmers got fed up with these really, really quickly, because they were just rotting after a few years. And then you had your PDM post, your pressure treated post with creosote, and there was, am I correct in saying, 20-25 year guarantee on some of those posts, Robert. Farmers really moved to those very quickly. Like, if you drive around now, they are the posts you see pretty much everywhere, even though they were expensive.
Yeah, look, I suppose PDM, who would have been the only licensed treating plant for creosote in Ireland, were offering a minimum of 15 years. They knew they would last 20 years and in excess, so they were very safe given that guarantee. Look, I suppose the challenge for us was to try and find a decent replacement product. And I suppose it's going to take maybe a little bit of time to build up confidence in other long-term products, because, as you say, creosote was the only name on the market when people came to reliability, you know.
Yeah, and your business being fencing products and fencing services, obviously that was the next step in the jigsaw. Where were you going to go? What sort of posts, I should say, were you going to use? And tell us what you sourced and what you've gone with, Robert.
Yeah, so look, we kind of offer a kind of wide range of material, but I suppose one of the ones that got our attention and that we grew our confidence in is an imported post that's called Jura 2. It's an Eastern European timber, so it's slow growing. It's a pine. It's a product that all the sapwood in the post is fully pressurized with treatment. Obviously, to do that, it has to be properly dried first, get full penetration then, and it's actually dried a second time and treated again with a black dye in it, the second treatment, and that's what kind of gives it the black look. So that's where we're tying some of our long-term prospects to, you know.
What country do they come from, Robert?
Look, it could be any of the Eastern European countries. I suppose traditionally some of this product might have come from Russia, but then there was a ban in importing timber from Russia into some of the Eastern European sawmills and that. So Eastern Europe, I suppose, and it could be a range of those countries where they're in, which, you know.
Yeah, and look, you're bringing them in. Obviously, this is what you had to, there was a problem, so you had to try and solve it, and this is the post you're now using. So farmers then are going to wonder, grand, okay, well, we'll go with this, we're going to trust FRS on this. It comes down to pricing then. So say, for example, a 5-foot post, it'd be the most standard used post around, use it for electric fence, maybe two strands of barb up in a hedge. What are we talking price-wise for the new Jura 2 on a 5-foot post, Robert, please?
Yeah, look, I as you say, we had a provisional chat yesterday about just kind of two kind of 5-foot posts there, a 5-foot 80mm post, so which is just over a 3-inch post, which maybe some guys on the dairy side of things would use within paddock fencing for single electric. You're up to €8 there, including VAT. If you want to go for a heavy 5-foot post, then they're retailing at €11 each, including VAT.
Yeah, okay. So they're, like, look, they're expensive, there's no question about it, but they're not monumentally more expensive than your creosoted post back in the day. Like, you were probably up around a tenner a post for those in the last maybe couple of years, am I right?
Yeah, look, obviously, creosote was getting scarce in the end, and because the prices rose to all suppliers for them, but yeah, creosote ended up thereabouts at that price. We'd love to have been able to come in with a good long-term product that cost a bit less, but unfortunately we couldn't get a good enough product that we would be happy to send over. So we've gone with Jura 2. It's come in around the same price as creosote.
What are we expecting? Obviously hard to tell, but lifespan-wise, at the Jura 2, are you hoping on that 15 years similar to the previous post?
Yeah, the Jura 2 offer a full 15-year guarantee. They do another 5-year step-back guarantee, so they reduced the percentage over the following 5 years. So up to 20 years of a guarantee with this post. Mm. Obviously, so long as it's not damaged or whatever, so it's against the post rotting or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I suppose, look, depends on land type as well, a small bit, those guarantees, and how long they'll last. Finally, Rob, before I let you go, FRS is well known for all the different services you provide, one of those being labour on farms. I know it's not your area, but labour in general, even to get fencers on the ground working for you to get people out, it's becoming a real issue in every aspect, every business, every farm. I'm sure it's the same for yourself, trying to get workers available for these physical jobs.
Yeah, look, you're lucky enough in our office that we kind of have the same guys over the long number of years, good experienced guys that know what they're doing. It is a real challenge to try and get extra labour, even as helpers for those teams. We seem to have no problem getting extra work, and sometimes it's actually a problem to deal with the work. Labour is a real challenge, and it's a real challenge even on the farm services point side when springtime hits. There's a deluge of work there for a couple of months, and it's proven a real challenge for everyone, you know.
Absolutely, Robert. Same story in all aspects of business. If people are interested in these posts, your standard, your yard, your depot in North Tip, Ross Gray, just there at the Mart, is kind of your main one for the Midlands.
Yeah, so we're based in beside the Mart in Ross Gray. A lot of people would be familiar with where the Mart is, and we do the full range of fencing products there, and we have different options, and with all the wire and gates and insulation, all the bits and pieces that go along with the fencing post. So we stock them all there. We sell directly to customers who want to wreck themselves, or they have a local small fence contractor they want to use, or we go out and price and supply and wreck ourselves, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, Robert. No, it's always well stocked. Everything's available there. And people, obviously, as you say, the Mart in Ross Gray is the kind of marker for it. Robert, I'm going to say many thanks for joining me here on the programme. A great rundown there on it. And look, I'm sure the Jura 2 post is going to be the future, because it's what farmers are going to go for. So hopefully it'll be a good news story in years to come. I'm sure it will be. Robert, many thanks for joining me here on the show.
MJ, thank you very much.
Robert Burney there, the fencing manager with FRS, Robert Salishman, and he's working in the Tipperary office there, North Tip. Just got into dairy in the last few years, he was telling me, and going well for him. Went down a robot system, so busy man, working full time dairy farming as well. And as he said, labour being the issue towards the back end of the chat there. And isn't that something we just hear week on week here in the programme, regardless of what industry or what area you are in, it is trying to get workers being the big problem now. Moving on to not solar after the break, but something similar to solar. So we're all familiar with solar farms, and indeed wind turbines on farms where farmers can generate income from those leasing them out. But there's a new aspect or avenue people can look at now, and that is positioning large batteries on your land and leasing that out to these developers, these solar developers. It's a new one. I only came across it a few weeks ago on the Irish Farmers Journal, but Marty Murphy from IFAC is the man in the know. So we're going to hear all about it in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Country Life on Midlands 103. Brought to you by W. Orshaw, Burlington Business Park, Tullamore. Supplier of New Holland's tractors in the Midlands. WOrshaw.ie.
And you're very welcome back to Country Life here on Midlands 103. Now, we are moving on to battery storage on farms and the possibility of income generation from it. Marty Murphy from IFAC joins me. Marty, many thanks for taking my call this evening.
No worries, MJ. Nice to be on. As you know, I'm coming in from IFAC. I'm the head of tax here at IFAC. We represent farmers throughout the country. We have about 16,000 farmers as clients. And we've 30 offices spread around the place. And we're into accountancy, tax, pension planning, food and advisory, and all that type of good stuff. So solar is very close to the home, as they say.
16,000 farmers on the go now, Marty. How long are you on the go, IFAC? I presume it was just a number of accountants got together at one stage and said, we'll start offering more agricultural-based services. And then it grew from that. I'm presuming that was the background of it.
It's not really. The background of IFAC is more of a co-op. So effectively, right. We're actually founded by our customers. So back in the 70s, effectively, the government decided that farmers would be subject to income tax. And as part of that kind of whole co-op movement back in the 70s, we were founded. So that's where our actual origins is. We aren't. I'm a partner with an IFAC, and I don't actually own equity or anything like that. That's actually held by our customers.
Ah, very good. Okay, yeah, that was the unfortunate time when income tax started to be charged to farmers. As you say, back in the 70s, I've often chatted to older farmers and they'd say whatever year it was, up to then, it was just fine. You just you went on as normal and was none of this annual paperwork to be put in or money to be paid across. How things have changed when you look at it now, what, 35, 40, 45 years later, tax being the main issue now on pretty much all farms across the country, because even if you have lowly stock, dry stock farmers, usually they're working off farm, so whatever money they're earning then is subject to the higher income tax, and then larger dairy farmers are wondering how they can minimise tax as well. So it's a big change in all those years.
Well, it's a huge change, and at the end of the day it can be an incredible burden when you're talking about effective tax rates up at 55%, where effectively for every euro that's coming into your pocket, half of it at least is going out on tax. So there's a reason that it's at the forefront of everyone's mind, and it's like everything else, the tax will drive a lot, and it's driving it a lot more just because of the costs involved. And it's like everything else, it's just another cost at the end of the day, and it has to be managed.
Yeah, and that is what it's all about. Management and good advice is the big one in relation to it. Marty, we're talking about battery storage. Now, I didn't know much about this, I won't lie, until I saw an article in the Farmers Journal, I don't know, maybe last month, and it's the possibility of farmers putting these large batteries on their land and then leasing it out to people. And what's the background of this, and why aren't people just going down the solar panel route? Why do they need to put batteries on land?
Now, for the majority of it, when we're looking at like the big lease out of the solar farms and all that type of good stuff, it's still the solar companies that are coming in and they're putting in basically their traditional solar panels. But they're also now, we're seeing in the options for the leases and things like that, where they're pushing for the batteries. Now, I'm no engineer, but my understanding from talking to the engineers and all that type of good stuff is, at the end of the day, you have to connect into air grid. And air grid can only take so much capacity at a time. So you have to think about it like with a motorway, with cars getting onto the motorway. Well, you've got your solar panels and the motorway is clear. It's nice and easy to get your planning permission to get your connection because you can get onto the motorway. But, you know, motorways are expensive to build. So what's happening with the planning and the connections to air grid and all that type of good stuff is effectively, in order to clear the motorway, solar farms are now going down the option, down the route of adding options for batteries. What the batteries will do is they'll charge off the grid and allow you further upstream to put the solar energy onto the grid. So it's been pushed more and more. Now, put it this way, if you're used to your own personal home and all that type of good stuff, if you think about it, batteries make a lot of sense because Ireland, unfortunately, has a lot of clouds and solar panels don't work too well when there's clouds. So it also very much helps from the perspective of actually smoothing the duck curve, as they call it. So effectively, when a cloud floats over and your solar panels drop for a couple of minutes, then instead of pulling the power off the grid, you can also pull it off your batteries. But from the largest installations, it's not really the solar panels that are charging the batteries. It tends to be more of the batteries are being charged by the grid to allow additional capacity and all that type of good stuff. Now, that's my basic understanding. I am a tax advisor. Well, it's like everything else, I stand to be corrected by any engineer, but at a very simple level, that's why batteries are becoming more and more important.
And is it going to be the case now that farmers will be approached and not being approached for leasing out your land as a solar farm, but leasing out your land as a battery farm, as in you're just going to have batteries on them, or do both of them go hand in hand?
Well, at the moment, it's going hand in hand. So any of the leases that we're seeing coming through at the moment, it's very much solar first and then battery on part of the solar farm. However, we have seen it overseas where it is 100% a battery farm. It's uncommon because AirGrid does take control of the actual batteries once the whole system goes live. So it might be AirGrid that starts to actually put in their own battery storage. So they do that, you know, close proximity to their own facilities. And we're not seeing individual companies doing it yet. So we'd still very much expect that basically whoever gets the generators and all that type of good stuff, the substations on their land, will likely also be approached looking for the battery storage as well. So we'd very much kind of see it as you'd have a good amount of solar, a small amount of area being taken for the batteries and another small area being taken for the substations.
And when we're talking about small areas, are we talking about, you know, maybe like a site where you build a house, half an acre, or are you talking a couple of acres, or like these batteries, they're pretty big, I presume.
They're pretty big. So the actual batteries come in things the size of containers that you see on the back of lorries and all that type of good stuff, but they are just a very small standard little battery that you would see the standard little ones that go into EVs and everything else. They're quite small, but it's combining thousands and hundreds of thousands of them together that give us this big, massive capacity. Now, as it actually, well, how many acres? What we're seeing is for about, effectively, it's for every 25 acres of solar panels, you're looking at about 1 acre of batteries. Hmm. Now, I'm not an engineer, so I don't know how they're doing the precise calculations.
Yeah, but roughly.
From the options that we have seen, it's normally about 4 acres to 100, 4 acres of batteries to 100 acres of solar panels.
Hmm. And on the...
If you're looking at the substations, it's about half an acre.
Yes, okay, for half an acre, yeah, very good. And on the actual leases then that you're seeing and that are crossing your desks in IFAC, we hear these figures of amounts per acre for 20-odd years, roughly, and we won't hold you to it, but thereabouts. Like, what is the actual kind of medium figure you're seeing for these solar farms?
Now, it's like everything else. The figures are coming through from every side. Whether or not the farms are going ahead is what's more important. And what I would point out is the last number of years, you know, there was huge... If you went back and we were having this conversation 6 years ago, if you were given a solar option lease, the general thoughts would be that all of these solar farms are going ahead. You know, 6 years later, and it turns out not a lot of them have gone ahead. Hmm. And that is hugely influenced on the value. So the value is somewhere being offered per acre between 700 and 1,500 euros. But whether or not that's ever actually been paid out as rent is a wild question at this stage, because there's just not enough farms operational yet to actually have taken up the income. Effectively, yeah. The lease has not been signed.
Yeah, it's like the leases being given for farmland, these huge amounts of money being given. It's kind of grand to write it up and to say you're going to give it, but actually getting it across the line and, you know, a farmer coming back, yeah, saying, right, I've received this money for the last 7 years, here it is in my bank account. That's the one where you really have to look at it, you know, with a fine-tooth comb. And the fact that they're being signed up, but as you say, how many of them actually hit the ground is the other one. It is the future, though, Marty, I would say. It seems to be where we're going. Like, if farms, I should say, are in the right position and grid connection and whatnot and all those different variables that they have, like, there is going to be so much money here available that it's likely farmers will go down this route.
Oh, it's definitely that farmers are going down this route, but it's not really an alternative. So it's not like I can just suddenly go out and go, well, I want to convert from basically a tillage farm into a dairy or anything like that. Like, you have to basically win the lotto a certain amount here to actually get into solar. And the reason for that is you're heavily reliant on being in the right position in the country and being very close to AirGrid's network. It's like everything else. You could be in a very good location, you're right beside the grid, there's a high-capacity line coming past you, but it's already full. And even with the battery, there's not enough capacity on it. So they estimate about 0.4% of the land in the country is useful for solar application, just based on location and all that type of good stuff, without having to do huge costs. Because obviously, if you're running pylons across fields and everything else, it can get very expensive very quickly. So while it's a great income and, you know, farmers are looking positively on it and they're seeing it as their contribution back and all that type of good stuff as well, it's still winning the lotto to a certain extent.
Yeah, there's a 0.4%. That is it's a tiny amount. Marty, I'm just out of time. I'm going to say many thanks for giving us the rundown on it there, and we will speak to you again here on the programme.
Great. Thanks very much, MJ.
Marty Murphy there from IFAC. And look, when you're going through all the logistics and all the particulars of this, as Marty said just towards the very end there, 0.4% of land in the country is what's currently suitable or useful for solar. It does show you the large chance that there is that, or the small chance, I should say, that there is that your land might be suitable for it. Now, moving on, and after the break, we are going to be talking to Eugene Larkin, and he's from Glenfield Oilseed Rape. He's just up the road from me. This is a family-run business where they are doing everything themselves, the Larkins here, from growing the plant right through to pressing it, right through to dropping it to all of the shops around the country that stock their product. So we're going to talk to Eugene in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Country Life on Midlands 103, brought to you by W. Orshaw Burlington Business Park Tullamore, supplier of New Holland's tractors in the Midlands. worshaw.ie.
And you're very welcome back to Country Life here on Midlands 103. And we're moving on to rapeseed oil and Glenfield rapeseed oil to be exact. Eugene Larkin, the Larkin family, are behind this. Neighbours of mine just up the road. Eugene, I'm going to say many thanks for joining me here this evening on the programme.
That's fine, JJ. You're welcome.
More than welcome, Eugene. It all came down to a lovely piece that you had written in the Farming Independent yesterday. People might have seen it. It was on the second last page under Farm Diversification. Lovely picture of yourself, your son Barry, and your granddaughter Holly right in the middle of one of your fields of rapeseed. Eugene, what's the background to this, please, to your what's now a business, but originally when you had your initial idea about it, what were you planning or what was the thought process?
Well, look, I suppose there wasn't really any plans in place, MJ, but we needed, because we were growing other crops, cereal crops, we kind of needed a break crop and looked at oilseed rape as a break crop, and it is an excellent break crop because you will get very good crops of cereal for a couple of years after, but you can only grow it once in every 5 years or thereabouts. But so we actually grew it originally and sold the crop for a couple of years, and then we started pressing the oil, and my brother started using it in his car, and I was using it in my farm Jeep at the same time, and that was successful enough, but probably wasn't really viable from the point of view of the cost that the white diesel, and that was it wasn't competitive with white diesel. So we looked at then maybe selling it, and originally we were selling it to the equine industry. They are very fond of it for the mixing a little bit with the feed for the horses. It's very good for the skeleton system of the animal, and also the coat gives them a very fine, shiny coat. So after that then, we started, we kind of reckoned that we could actually sell this, bottle it and sell it and be as competitive as possible with any other producer. So that's pretty much how it started.
How it started and where it's going today. But there's a lot of work, a lot of logistics involved with Eugene from start to finish. Like, a lot of farmers are happy the day they harvest the crop, that's it, they're finished up and off it goes. But really the day you harvest the crop, the work only starts. You're going the whole way through from start through to finish. So just logistically, you know, from week to week, it's a lot of work, it's a family business. How do you keep it all going without messing up supplies and ensuring you have enough stock and getting all the deliveries out? You're doing that part of it as well. It's a lot to contend with.
Yeah, without going mad, you really should say, MJ. But look, I suppose because we have four or five of the family involved, it kind of helps an awful lot. So my son Barry there, who you can see on the Farming Independent there, he is actually an agronomist by qualification, and he grows the crops and looks after all the crops and all that. And then once we harvested, which is actually, while I'm speaking about harvesting, it's probably the trickiest part of the whole thing, because you only have a very short window with oilseed rape, because it once it gets ripe, if you can't harvest it, you can lose huge volume of it. But anyway, so look, once we harvested, we dry it, and then we put it into these big bin containers, grain bins, and once it's dried, it's quite stable, then it will keep very happily there for a couple of years if you need to. And look, I have helped then obviously with my son Patrick and my daughter Eugenie, who helped very well in the plant on the bottling and the boxing of the oil, labelling and all that. Also, it's worth mentioning that my brother Fintan, who would have started this business originally with myself, he looks after a lot of the technical thing in the plant, where the cleaning of the seed and the pressing of the oil and the filtering of the oil. So that's his end of the bit.
Everyone has their own area of expertise, if you will, Eugene. It's a really well-known product now, I have to say, from popping around into shops, and it was the Super Value, the Food Academy. You got into that a number of years ago. That really must have propelled you up to a new stage, really, of familiarity and indeed profitability, I suppose, because you look, you were selling more and more than you were originally.
Yeah, look, being accredited with Musgrave's on the Food Academy made a huge difference to us, because that gave us so many more outlets, pretty much every super value in the country. If we could reach on them, they would know of our product, and I have to say they would be excellent partners to work with. And look, it propelled our business to a point where we were flat out actually manufacturing and making the oil and delivering.
Delivering is the big one, Eugene. I said to myself, you must be using maybe some sort of a courier company or something, but no, it really is from start to finish. This is your area, the logistics of delivering, Eugene, so you must be on the road 24/7 trying to keep it stocked everywhere.
Well, look, I have different routes. Say, once every month we will deliver to each shop, and I have a different route planned for each day. So I will do about 10 different super values and butcher shops and fruit and veg shops in any particular one run. But we're covering an area from Sligo down to Cork and over across to Wexford, back up and all around Dublin, Meath, Longford, Roscommon, Westmeath, and all into Galway. It's a huge area. I do a lot of driving. But look, I enjoy meeting people, and I also find that actually, if the owner is actually meeting the retailers, there's nothing like face-to-face, and you can see that the shelf is fully stocked and it's in a good place, and it makes an awful difference compared to using a courier. Mm. Originally, we were using couriers, but that was a nightmare, a headache, because we had nothing, only boxes of broken bottles coming back, and it was just a logistic nightmare, really.
Mm. Well, it's a real success story, Eugene. I have to say to yourself and the whole Larkin family, your brother as well, everyone who's involved in it, it's fantastic to see what can happen and what can occur in a farm if you're willing to put in the work. Now, there's a big if there, because you're working very, very hard at this, and it's great to see you going well at it. We wish you all the best here in the programme, and our listeners can pick up Glenfield rapeseed oil in any super value around the Midlands. I know Buckley's have Burr, Moat and Mullingar, you're there, but you're in lots of them around, and I'm sure you're going to go from strength to strength. Eugene, many thanks for talking to me here on the programme.
Yeah, thanks, MJ. Just before we go, I'd really like to thank any customers that go into those shops and buy our product. They will see that it is an excellent product, and I really appreciate their business.
Thank you
for having me on the programme.
Oh, you're more than welcome, Eugene, and a lovely thing to say there at the end, because at the end of the day, your customers are your number one, but it's nice to hear it.
Absolutely.
Eugene, many thanks, and we'll speak to you again. Goodbye.
Thank you, MJ. Take care. Bye-bye.
Eugene Larkin from, as I said, Glenfield Rapeseed Oil, and the Larkins are neighbours of mine. They're just up the road. Started that business about 10 years ago, I would say, and it has gone from strength to strength, and it really is a success story of what can occur, and the business that can occur on a small farm, or a farm, any farm. You don't have to go into huge, large scale cow numbers or whatever the case may be. You can make a product and you can bring it all the way through, but a lot of work involved in it, and the logistics on delivery, that's the one I'm scratching my head with. Eugene must be on the road all day every day, but look, he sounds like he's enjoying it, and meeting the customers being the big one. So as I said, Glenfield Rapeseed Oil, that's it for this evening's programme. I'd like to thank you all for listening over the course of the last hour, and to thank my guests Eugene Larkin there, also Marty Murphy from IFAC, Robert Burney from FRS talking about fence and posts, and at the start of the hour we had Joe Patton from Chagas. Show is repeated on Sunday morning at 7 a.m. through to 8 a.m. I'll be back with you this time next week. As always, you can get us wherever you get your podcasts. If you type in MJ space Cleary, C-L-E-R-Y, we will pop up, and you can listen at your leisure. I'll speak to you in 7 days time. Good night and God bless.
Life on Midlands 103. Brought to you by W. Orshaw, Burlington Business Park, Tullamore. Supplier of New Holland's tractors in the Midlands. worshaw.ie.